Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
The convenience of plastic has made it popular for so many applications that you would be hard-pressed to avoid it in nearly any purchase. But plastic is stubbornly resistant to biodegrading, so that convenience has a high environmental and possibly human health price. Microplastics are the result of that persistence for plastic to stick around, and the smaller the particles, the more they can permeate the environment and be absorbed into plants, water, and us. New tools by Alaska Pacific University researchers may help identify the level of harm. We'll discuss the science today on Talk of Alaska.
Alaska Public Media is all about community. Wear your community on your sleeve with the purchase of branded clothes and collectibles from our online store. Visit alaskapublic.org/shop.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. If you are over a certain age, you may remember when plastics were exciting. From Bakelite in the 1930s to Tupperware parties through the 60s and 70s, where local ladies brought resealable plastic containers right to your house to sell to your friends. Plastic was used in ceiling tiles, insulation, furniture, and then plastic wraps and bags became ubiquitous, carrying groceries and covering single-use containers. Einstein's brain even spent time in Tupperware. Plastic's versatility and convenience made it popular, but as more and more of it piled up in landfills, on beaches, blowing around on city streets, it became obvious that unlike paper and cardboard, it wouldn't molder into the ground and disappear. It persists for decades, getting ground up into smaller and smaller pieces that can then be carried by wind and currents, polluting soils, water, and our bodies. And that's a health concern that scientists are working to better understand. Here today to help us understand the risk and what some solutions for dealing with it could be is Pam Miller. Pam is the Executive Director and Senior Scientist for the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, or ACAT. And Deani Chapman is the State Director of Alaska Environment Research and Policy Center. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on with us today. We had hoped to get Dr. Dee Barker, a chemist and professor at APU, Alaska Pacific University. Dr. Barker is the principal investigator for a NASA-funded study on tracking microplastics in fresh and ocean water. Dr. Barker couldn't be with us today, but Pam and Deani are also doing this work and can help us understand the scope of the problem. So, Pam, I want you to start us off here. You've been at the helm of ACAT, Alaska Community Action on Toxics, for nearly 30 years. You started the organization to respond to environmental health concerns of Alaskans. When did you first start studying microplastics?
Well, it's been several years. We've worked on international issues concerning chemical contamination of the Arctic because early on we realized that the Arctic and the North serve as hemispheric sinks for chemicals, and they tend to move into this region on wind and ocean currents and then accumulate in the bodies of fish, wildlife, and people. And really shortly after that, we began to also understand that the Arctic and the North serve as hemispheric sinks for microplastics, which are also carried on wind and ocean currents into this region and also accumulate in the bodies of fish, wildlife, and people. And we're very concerned, not only because the microplastics themselves can be harmful and cause physical damage to our bodies, but because these microplastics can carry chemicals into this region that they absorb as they're floating in the environment. And we know that more than 16,000 chemicals are used in the production of plastic. So the microplastics serve as conveyors of chemicals into remote regions such as the North and the Arctic.
All right. Thanks for getting us started there with that high level of concern. You're also the co-chair of IPEN, the International Pollutants Elimination Network. And last year you wrote an op-ed on the threat of plastics to climate and health, calling for support for a UN-sponsored treaty on plastics. That was in 2024. Where is that treaty work today?
Well, we just completed the sixth negotiating session of the plastics treaty that was held in Geneva in August. And unfortunately, the countries of the world could not come to an agreement, largely because the key provisions of a strong plastics treaty were blocked by petrochemical producing states such as Russia, China, India, Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. The U.S. has played a very negative role in this process. So there will be future negotiating sessions, but we don't yet have a plastics treaty.
All right. Well, Pam, thank you for starting us off. We'll talk more about that concern and why you're calling for this treaty on plastics. But Diane, I want to turn to you now. You conducted a study in 2023 taking water samples from a broad swath of South Central waterways. Your research had unhappy results. Tell us what you found in these water samples.
Yeah, so we tested 39 different sources in South Central Alaska, and it was a range somewhere from local creeks and rivers, from lakes. We did a couple saltwater samples. We did a couple drinking water samples in Anchorage as well. And we found microplastics in 100% of those samples. And it was pretty small samples, too. We took three quart jars, essentially, of water from each of these locations. So when you think about the fact that we found microplastics in all of them, even though we had relatively small samples, it just illustrates how pervasive this problem is.
You noted in an Alaska Public Media story about this research that urban areas had lower concentrations than non-urban areas. That seemed kind of counterintuitive to what I would have expected. Why do you think that was the case?
Yeah, so I think that my best guess on that is that while we do produce plastic pollution locally in Alaska, one of the things about plastic and microplastics specifically is they move around the world a lot through ocean currents, through atmospheric currents. And so in places that have more rainfall or more snowfall, those can end up with really large amounts of microplastic depositions. And so, you know, it's something that we need to deal with in our own lives and here in Alaska, but it's also something that we need to make sure that the rest of the United States and the rest of the world is also moderating their plastic use overall. And then there was a couple examples. Kenai Lake had we found a huge number of microplastics in Kenai Lake, and a lot of them were sort of very clear, thin lines that looked suspiciously like fishing line. And so I think that there's some examples of very local source pollution there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Sadly, that makes sense.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about ongoing research into microplastics in water and soil and in our bodies. In the studio with me today is Diane Chapman. Diane is the State Director of Alaska Environment Research and Policy Center. And on the line with us is Pam Miller. Pam is the Executive Director and Senior Scientist for Alaska Community Action on Toxics, or ACAT. For both of you, Dr. Barker is working on a NASA-funded study tracking microplastics in water. Have you worked with Dr. Barker in any of this research that's going on at APU? And is it known if this funding is safe? It's $5 million over 5 years. It started last year. Any idea about whether there's threats against this funding that she has currently?
We have talked with graduate students and Dr. Barker about the research, and I'm very excited about it because it's so important. Because right now there's no systemic way to look at the contamination of microplastics in drinking water sources and other surface and groundwater sources of water. So it's really important to have this research. So I can't say or not, because I think so much is uncertain right now about funding and at the federal level. But I will say it's really critical because our Department of Environmental Conservation, for example, does not monitor for microplastics in drinking water sources. They do require monitoring for other chemical contamination, but not microplastics. So it's really important for us to have a comprehensive understanding of mm-hmm. this. And I think this study by APU will be really important.
Deanne, please.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add is I think Pam's answer largely covers it. And one thing that gives me hope is that I think especially over the past 5 years or so, concern over microplastics has, in plastic in general, has really grown. And I don't think that it's particularly bound by ideology now. There's, you know, MAHA mom groups that are really concerned about it. There's scientists that are really concerned about it. There's doctors that are really concerned about it. There's a lot of individuals that are really concerned about it. And that bodes well for continued funding and figuring out how to deal with this problem, is that it's really something that everyone at this point cares about.
And Dr. Barker is studying the chemical composition and also looking to develop work with instruments that can see very, very tiny, tiny particles, 10 microns or even less. And we'll talk more about that as we go forward. What should people know about the composition of plastics? What is this stuff made of?
What a good question. Go for it, Pam.
Go ahead. All right. Plastics are derived from fossil fuels. About 99% of plastics are derived from fossil fuels. And then there are literally thousands of chemical additives that are used in the production of plastics. Over 16,000 chemicals that are used as stabilizers and to convey softening properties and fire retardants and dyes and fillers. And there's a real lack of transparency about chemicals in plastics. So I'm quite concerned again about the microplastics themselves, because they do get into our body, and there's been a great deal of evidence now that shows that these microplastics are entering our bodies. They're in our brains, they're in women's placenta, they're in our reproductive organs, they're in virtually every organ of our body. And I think we're just really beginning to understand the implications of that. But I think some of the latest research shows that exposure is associated with increased risk of miscarriages, premature and stillbirth, birth defects, impaired lung growth, even childhood cancer, as well as fertility problems. And some of the latest research has shown that exposures are also linked with strokes and heart attacks. So again, these particles are able to enter in our blood, our brains, breast milk, placentas, and semen and bone marrow. So they've really invaded our bodies.
Deanne, did you want to add?
Yeah, so I think that there's a couple things that I would add is that plastics are chains of artificial polymers. And when animal and plant products go out into our environment, bacteria and fungi can break those down and turn them back into carbon and nitrogen and other minerals that can then be used in the creation of new life. But one of the things with these polymers is that bacteria can't break them down on at least any timeline that we're familiar with at this point. So, you know, it takes hundreds of years at minimum. And what that means is that instead of going away and going back into our environment in a way that those chemicals can be used in new life forms, they end up just breaking into smaller and smaller pieces. And then, like Pam said, there's a lot of chemicals that we use directly with our plastics, flame retardants, BPAs, phthalates, there's proven endocrine disruptors. And so, you know, there's a huge number of health impacts when plastics haven't attracted anything else from our environment. And then that also can cause, along with causing problems for people, it also can cause problems for our wildlife. There was a study done where salmon were exposed to polystyrene nanoparticles, and those salmon ended up eating less food and they were less adept at avoiding predation, and they experienced reduced mobility as well. And then there's also some interesting studies where algae would absorb the microplastics, and then they would photosynthesize less efficiently. And that just has implications for our entire ocean ecosystems as well. And so, you know, there's a lot of different problems, both for people and for our wildlife and for our environment as a whole.
Are either of your organizations testing in wild food sources? Do you find bioaccumulation in marine mammals, in fish? Either organization working on those kinds of tests or in knowledge of them?
We're actually planning a study to look at microplastics in various fish and wildlife species. And the University of Alaska at Fairbanks has a number of studies ongoing. So microplastics have been found in many, many different fish species, as well as walrus, bearded seal, ringed seal, spotted seal, minke whale, humpbacks, and beluga, as well as many of the bird species that we find here in the north. So there's been quite a bit of research. It's mostly looking at the presence of microplastics. And there was a study done by a scientist named Veronica Padula who looked at microplastics in seabirds and found that those microplastics did in fact convey a very harmful class of chemicals into the bodies of the seabirds called phthalates, which are plasticizers used in the production of plastics. So there has been some research. I'd say there needs to be a lot more, but we're looking to do some community-based research concerning microplastics in animals.
And are you will you include terrestrial animals, moose, caribou, things like that?
Yes, and that's important as well.
And Deani, what other tests is your organization doing in relation to microplastics in our environment? Are you doing any human health testing looking for these contaminants in Alaskans?
So not right now. We are in conversation with Pam and ACAT talking about some of the research that they're doing and what are some of the ways that we can engage more. One of the things that I'm sort of thinking about all of this, though, is that we know microplastics are everywhere at this point, and there's been a lot of research, and we know that they're in our drinking water, and then we know that they're in our oceans, and we know that they're in animals and our fish, and we know that they're in people. And we know that there's a lot of negative implications. And so in some ways, the thing that I'm focused at now is how do we actually solve this problem? Because we know that it is a problem that needs to be solved at this point. So thinking about how we can actually reduce the number of microplastics that are getting out into our environment.
Let's go to Jason in Copper Valley. Mm-hmm. Hello, Jason.
Thank you for taking my call. One of the sort of elephants in the room, of course, is our clothing and how we go about, you know, what our choices there. A lot of plastics in our clothing that happens in the dryer. We're getting microplastics also in the wash water. The subtleties of shifting towards cotton, flax, leather, wool, and also shifting the mentality of you can keep the natural fibers just as clean if you're worried about overall social presentation, but you now discover that you need less clothing because they wear better. That would be one. The other one is sort of, this is off topic, but I've been squirreling on this disposal for a long time out here and watching. I mean, you ask about why microplastics are more higher in the rural areas. We have a lot more visqueen and blue tarps out in rural areas to start with. And UV just tears them up. And all of a sudden, you're cleaning up a bunch of shards, a little bit of plastic in your yard and stuff like that. What are we going to do with them? One level is, of course, put them in the landfill. And that's what's saving them for their future generations, because their future generations will go in and extract the resources from our landfills that we've casually thrown there. And the other one is, well, let's break it down. Highly recommend, you know, when you're doing your brush piles, good clean burn and break it down the best you can and burn it up. At least it's turning into smaller bits of stuff for the environment to deal with. Now, to the side of a more responsible level than having a bunch of people burning plastic in the front yard, moving towards and as this industry that we see, the plasma furnaces, a lot of plasma furnaces out there, and they're actually taking our plastic waste and then recycling it back into the petroleum that it started out with. So a couple of considerations. One is shifting around your clothing choices, and the next one is, you know, let's start considering what we're doing with the stuff. I mean, if we're taking it to the landfill, why? And or let's find an alternative to the landfill, because though the redneck version of burning it on a good hot fire is may sound cute around the whiskey bottle, there are more responsible resolutions than that.
You know, thanks for the call, Jason. I was reminded of something that Dr. Barker said in a previous interview about her research and the importance of not believing everything you read online. No kidding. She said that there's some folks are advocating for boiling water, that you'll get rid of microplastics by boiling water, which I can't even comprehend why anyone would think that would work. But she said that she's seen that online and that people should know that, no, boiling water is not going to remove microplastics. For both of you, we just heard Jason talk about, you know, plastics in yards and tarps and landfills. Where are most of them coming from? Is it mainly local landfills, or are a lot of these toxins coming from other countries? Pam?
I would say the majority of microplastics entering this region are transported internationally through wind and ocean currents. Certainly local sources are important, and we have to do whatever we can to reduce the sources of plastics in our own communities. I think Jason raises a very important point about clothing as a major source of microfibers, because a lot of these, well, the synthetic fabrics are plastic, essentially. So relying more on natural fibers is really, really important. And also, I think doing what we can to reduce plastics in our own communities and in our own homes. But I think we have to realize that we cannot shop our way out of this problem. And that's why policy, and I was really glad that Diani raised that issue. We have to address this on a policy level, at all levels, from local to international, because these are chemicals and plastics that do not respect political boundaries. So local landfills can be important sources. It's also very important not to burn them, whether in your backyard or in burn barrels or burn boxes associated with landfills, because plastics, when they're burned, generate toxic chemicals such as dioxins and furans that are highly hazardous to human health.
Yeah, the idea of burning plastics is, just don't do it. That's a really, really bad idea. Such toxic smoke coming off of that. Pam, I want to stay with you for just a minute. You've been part of a study on St. Lawrence Island related to PCB contamination for many years. I believe it's the longest ongoing study of this kind anywhere. Tell us about where this work is today in relation to ongoing testing, and does this research also look at plastic contamination?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Yes, we've done community-based research on St. Lawrence Island, the traditional name is Sivocock, since 2000. And we've looked at chemicals including PCBs, flame retardants, and also PFAS chemicals in fish and wildlife and people, and we've measured human health effects from exposure to those chemicals. So we found that those chemicals are definitely endocrine disrupting. They disrupt the endocrine system for example, thyroid and reproduction. And the levels in people of St. Lawrence Island and the Arctic in general can be many times higher than are found in people in the lower 48 because of this phenomenon of global distillation, which just means that, again, these chemicals and microplastics are transported into this region where they tend to bioaccumulate. We haven't yet begun a systematic study of microplastics, but that's definitely in the plan, within our future hopes and plans.
All right. And Diani, you've been testing around South Central. What are you discovering about where the sources of these materials are?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different sources for microplastics. There's clothing is definitely significant. A huge amount of our clothing is made out of plastics now. And there's both, there's sort of been a rise in how quickly we go through clothing with fast fashion. People buy more and use it for shorter periods of time. But even beyond that, there's some new stats that are coming out that somewhere between 20 and 40% of clothing never makes it out of a store at all. And so then they end up either landfilling it or incinerating it, which contributes a lot to microplastic pollution as well. And so there's definitely some big things that we need to do in that regard. Something that with the sort of whether it's coming from the U.S. or from other places, it's definitely this is a global problem. But I would note that folks in the United States are some of the biggest consumers of plastic. And so even while a lot of it's produced in other countries, it's definitely something that we play a significant role in and therefore can also play a significant role in the solution, which I think is that's an empowering thing, is like we can help solve this problem. But clothing is definitely a big source. Car tires are a big source, and that's a harder one to figure out how to deal with. There's also just a lot comes from single-use plastic that is stuff that, you know, it might make our life convenient, but we actually really could just do without it. We can take a little more effort and we can make it so that we can protect our wildlife and our health and sort of put that above there. Packaging is another really big source of plastic pollution. And I think that's frustrating for a lot of people, where when you go into any given store or you order something online, you end up with way more packaging than you want. And it's really incredibly hard to avoid it. We've got a couple different things that we're doing there. We're running some corporate campaigns with some national partners to get Amazon to reduce some of their plastic packaging, and they are making progress, even if it's not all the way done. We're also working to get Costco to reduce their plastic packaging. And so I think that's sort of another approach to it overall. But there's a lot of different sources of plastic pollution that we need to tackle.
It is stunning that 20 to 40% of manufactured clothing ends up not being purchased, but ends up in a landfill. That's got to change. That's hideous waste.
It is. It's so much waste.
Before we take a break, I want to just read an email that we got in from RB3. They say, several years ago, I asked our local electric utility, GVEA, about the huge amount of plastic flagging they leave on rights of way. I asked about using biodegradable flagging, but they said they could not be seen by crews as well as the plastic version. I bought some for comparison, and the difference is slight, if any. Since they do all of their work on rights of ways in the daylight of summer, I question that. They also said they remove the flagging when they're done with maintenance. I have never seen this happen. Our local member-owned utility, along with many others, continues to spread plastic flagging. I assume flagging is abundant all over the Arctic, just like here in Fairbanks. So these are really interesting notes about, you know, the large and small ways that plastics are ubiquitous throughout our society and causing this problem. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion and look for some solutions about what people can do to help avoid plastics as Talk of Alaska continues.
Consider a gift of stock to Alaska Public Media. You may avoid paying capital gains tax and receive a deduction. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/stock or contact your financial advisor.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about microplastics and research into the harm that they present to our environment and to ourselves. Dr. Barker's project uses specialized microscopes that can see very tiny particles of plastics, less than 50 microns. And Dr. Barker hopes to be able to get to the point of identifying plastics as small as 10 or even 5 microns. What do either of you know about the concern with these very small particles under 10 microns? And why is it important to be able to clearly see what those particles are? Diani?
Yeah, well, so one of the things that I would say is that we do have water filters for our drinking water that can filter out a lot of microplastics. But nanoplastics are a whole other question, and so understanding where they are and what filters work with them is definitely an important thing to know, and it will just help us understand sort of more broadly how big of a problem nanoplastics are if we know where they are, and then we can figure out what kind of problems they're causing as well.
What are your thoughts about that, Pam?
Well, I think it's really important to look at micro and nanoplastics, because these are the sizes of plastics that can cross the blood-brain barrier. So these micro and nanoplastics are now found in the brains of our children. They're conveyed to the next generation through the placenta and through breast milk. And I think it's really important to understand how these chemicals, how these plastics and the chemicals associated with them enter our bodies and how they affect our health. Because again, the chemicals that are in these microplastics are also conveyed into our bodies.
And as we've been discussing, they're everywhere: water, soil, plants, animals, people. How do you help the public understand the concern without creating a sense of hopelessness over something that seems so overwhelming? When you talk about these in public settings, how do you help people understand that there are steps they can take?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this is we do have so many different solutions that we can implement. And the ones that I'm most interested in are the ones that turn off the tap, is sort of the analogy. So the idea there is, if your bathtub is overflowing, you're going to need to do some cleanup after the fact, but the first thing that you do is stop adding more water to the tub. And I think that there are just so many different steps that we can take to reduce the amount of plastic that's going out into our environment. There's legislation that's being considered currently by the legislature to ban polystyrene takeout containers, which is a particularly gnarly type of plastic.
And for folks that aren't familiar with polystyrene, that's styrofoam, that white stuff that is so bad. And yeah, you shouldn't get carryout in that.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, styrofoam, sort of, it's the brand name for it. And then polystyrene is the colloquial name. And then there's other cool efforts at play as well. A very local one in Anchorage is there is a Girl Scout troop that I'm working with, and they are working to get plastic glitter banned in their school, in the Anchorage school districts, which is very cool. And glitter is sort of interesting because that is an intentional microplastic that we've created. Mm-hmm. And so that's another really cool way to deal with it. There's a lot of things that we can do in our personal lives. There's a lot of ways that we can ask corporations to make changes. So there's so many different solutions. And I think that's one of the big ways of making it so it doesn't seem like a hopeless situation, is that there are so many steps we can take to make this problem not as bad as it is.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Truman is in Fairbanks. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Did you have an idea?
I was concerned about you guys talking about plastic all over. And yes, I'm concerned too. And I was thinking, since America is pretty sophisticated, and I should think they should place some of the plastic containers, like in the stores and stuff, with wood. And then it might help out with some of the problem. But, and there would be other ways too, like plants, you know, like leaves. Maybe they can use some of that, because there's a lot of leaves. I think they can do something with them. But,
yeah, thank you, Truman. I think you're onto something there with the idea of wood and plant material. I know that there are some biodegradable type containers that people can use, especially for carry out. I see Diani is nodding. I think, Pam, what are your thoughts about those types of innovations in using more eco-friendly materials for things like packaging?
Yes, I think Truman raises a really important point that there are alternative materials that can be used. And I think to follow on what Diani was saying as well, I think we need to look at alternative materials in our own homes. So instead of plastic, we can use glass, stainless steel. It's really important for all of us to avoid, especially single-use plastics, and it's important from a health perspective, never to microwave in plastics, because the plastics are not inert and they do release chemicals into the beverage or food in which they are microwaved. So important. And another thing that we can do in our own homes is that you can get a filter for your washing machine that can help to remove plastics that would otherwise be released into our waters downstream. But I think we do have to look at things that we can do in our own homes and in our purchasing choices, but we cannot solve this problem on our own. And that's why it's so important to look at policy opportunities at all levels, from local to international. Bethel, just very recently, within the past couple of days, passed an ordinance to ban plastic bags and polystyrene food packaging. So that's an example of a local ordinance. And Diani mentioned our state legislation, which is House Bill 25, which would ban the use of polystyrene food packaging in food establishments against styrofoam, because polystyrene food packaging is harmful, it's carcinogenic, it breaks down easily into microplastics, and then gets released into the environment as one of the most prevalent sources of plastics in our environment. And then again, at the international level, because we cannot solve this problem even as one country, it has to be solved by the nations of the world to come together and establish a strong, legally binding, health protective treaty to eliminate the harmful uses of plastics, to limit plastics production, as well as eliminating harmful chemicals in plastics.
You know, when you mention trying to get rid of polystyrene styrofoam, which, that stuff is just hideous. I know people who have arranged with local restaurants, excuse me, to allow them to bring their own containers for carryout. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of other folks doing this? And do you think this is an approach that makes sense?
I love that idea. It's, you know, it gets a little bit more complicated if you're thinking about delivery. But it is one of, a couple years ago on Anchorage Reddit, there was actually a picture of this woman who walked into a Taco King and she had her glass casserole pan and she's like, fill it up with enchiladas. And I think that people were maybe joking that she was going to try and pass them off as her own enchiladas. But I was like, no, this is great. This is what people should be doing. And I think it's a good thing to
whether
remember.
Whether she does or not, it's
yeah,
still
like
good.
Whatever seems you do you, that's great. But I think there's sort of a broader thing where we, you know, plastic is relatively new, which means that for a lot of things, we have other ways that we have figured out how to do it. And there's some very cool uses of plastic that have really made our lives better. And those are going to be some different considerations. But we, from 2011 to 2021, plastic production increased by 40%. And I don't actually, you know, between 2011 and 2021, there's not that much different. Like, we could get rid of a lot of that plastic production and our lives would be just as high quality as before. And so I think it's one of those things where, you know, nothing that we use for 5 minutes should pollute our environment for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And we need to, even if it's a little less convenient and it takes a little bit more time, we shouldn't be trading our health and wildlife for convenience.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. John is in Anchorage. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. Did you have a question?
No, I have a comment, which is that there's a huge amount of contamination in Prince William Sound, and much of it ends up on Montague Island. And Chris Pallister has worked on for years on trying to collect that material, recycle it, and actually has a project going on where he's hoping to be able to fix this plastic a waste into a non-reactive material that can be handled. And I think he's working with one of the large oil companies or chemical companies, excuse me, to try to effectively complete that task. But the reality of it is the amount of material that we're talking about here is astronomical. It's tons and tons. And this is in Alaska, which is in Prince William Sound, which is a pristine area. But in fact, it's heavily contaminated by plastics. And about 10 or 12 years ago, we did a project when I was a professor at UAA looking at the impact of the phthalates that are present in the plastics in salmon in Cook Inlet. And in fact, it shows that they do respond, or the actual enzymes that are involved in accelerating cancer-causing reactions are impacted by those chemicals. So there's a whole bunch of issues here that really need to be addressed. But the reality of it is we're talking about tons of material. It's not a trivial thing. And it's going to be very difficult to stop an industrial effort that has been growing over time without some tremendous change in conceptualization and political action to do something about it. So it's almost a frightening thing once you realize the implications of it all. But I did want you to know that there is some effort being taken to actually clean up the material that's contaminating our local oceans, for example. So thank you.
Thank you for the call, John. And yes, I know that there are groups that get together every year and go out to remote islands in Alaska and collect tons and tons of waste from those places that, as John said, you would think would be pristine. But they certainly attract on ocean currents the trash that comes from our country and other countries as well. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on microplastics and how people can advocate for change as Talk of Alaska continues. Tim writes, hello, TOA folks. Thanks for focusing on the alarming, omnipresent threat of microplastics to our health and our planet's health. Here's my question. For years, my wife and I have been using reusable plastic produce bags to contain our veggies in the refrigerator. We read years ago, these reusable bags preserve produce better and reduce the amount of things like plastic bags that people get at grocery stores for their veggies. They bring reusable fabric bags for produce to the store. Tim writes, but lately it's occurred to us that maybe it's not a good idea to continue to use those reusable plastic bags because they may shed microplastic particles into our produce. Can you please inform us about that? Should we stop using reusable plastic bags and substitute them for produce bags made of fabric or some other innate material? I bet I know the answer to this, but Deani?
Yeah, so I think there's always tiers to solutions. And I think it is way better to reuse a reusable plastic bag than it is to use a fresh plastic bag. It is probably even better to use a cotton bag or some other natural fiber bag because you do just then reduce your exposure to plastics that much more. One of the things, though, that we always talk about with zero waste is that we need a lot of people doing it imperfectly, not a couple people doing it perfectly. And so, you know, I take the steps that you can, and it's okay if you're not ready for the next step, because the way that we do this is by a whole lot of people engaging and shifting sort of our overall cultural around this, which can make it so that we can eventually get the right policy in place and get our companies to do the right things.
I'm glad that it's become much more acceptable at places where you shop to bring your own bags with you. I have a whole bunch of them in the backseat of my vehicle all the time. And so it's nice that stores don't look askance at you now when you come in with your own bags. Pam, I wanted to move to a concern that you've raised, that as many countries turn to cleaner fuel sources and away from fossil fuels, that oil development companies are finding new products to put petroleum into, like plastics. Talk a little about that concern.
Yes, it is true that the fossil fuel industry is looking for other ways to use their products, and they're actually investing much more in the production of chemicals and plastics. And by their own projections, the increase in the production of chemicals and plastics will increase exponentially over the next few decades unless we can stop that process through mechanisms like the Global Treaty on Plastics to limit production for not only fossil fuel production, but also for chemicals and plastics, and to find other solutions, materials, and ways to solve this huge global crisis that is a global health crisis.
How can and should people work for change? Deanna, you mentioned that, you know, we don't need a couple of people doing things perfectly. We need lots of people doing things as best they can. Where do you see examples? We talked a little about this earlier, but where are examples of states or other countries where there is good progress being made at reducing plastic waste and also moving to different alternatives so that you're just not incorporating and bringing more in all the time? Where do you see examples of that? Pam?
Well, I think here in the U.S., a number of states are taking measures to address microplastics, intentionally added microplastics, single-use and problematic plastics such as PVC and other ones that tend to be highly toxic. Polystyrene is another example. So I see some really encouraging movement at the state level and also at the international level. Several countries, for example, have banned single-use plastics, for example. So I think there are a lot of really promising efforts, but these efforts really require collective engagement. And I think going back to your earlier question, what gives us hope when it looks really quite dire? And it is working for this kind of change, whether it's a local ordinance like they just achieved in Bethel, or state legislation, or national and international work. There's so many opportunities for us to work toward positive change to limit the production of plastics and the uses of plastics, and to educate ourselves and our communities on ways that we can collectively address this problem.
Deanna, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that often comes up in these conversations is a little bit about how much personal action do we need to take and how much systemic change needs to happen. And the way that I think about this is we need a lot of systemic change here. But a lot of that actually will stem from a lot of personal decisions. And so I want people thinking about this as voters and as consumers and as shareholders. And if in all of those different capacities, we are supporting reducing the use of single-use plastics and choosing materials that are actually going to decompose and that are going to last longer and not just be thrown out after a couple uses. And if we're encouraging companies to also create the kinds of products that we want and not create the kinds of products that we don't want or too much of any given product, even if we do need it, I think that's really important. There's a set of different ways that we need to engage. And we do see good examples of this happening sort of around the United States and then also internationally. And there's sort of a lot of different approaches. There's sort of stopping the use of particularly bad products. And then there's also efforts where it's like, you know, producers need to be responsible for the end of life of products, and so they have to have a plan for it. They can't just be the landfill. And I think, you know, there's a lot of different options, and I'm excited to see what Alaska does next.
Where is HB 25? Is it something that you expect will see some movement in January?
Well, I'm really optimistic about HB 25. Again, that's a bill introduced by Representative Andy Josephson, and we're really grateful for him for his work on this. It has passed through two committees in the House, and so now it's referred to the House Rules Committee. So, and it has enjoyed very much bipartisan support through the two committees that it has passed. And I think there's a lot of really good momentum, and we hope to get it passed early as possible in the second session that begins in January 2026. So we're talking to legislators, we're raising support. We have a petition signed by hundreds of people to support HB 25, and I think we have a good chance.
The Trump administration ignores climate science, cutting off funding for renewable energy and other efforts aimed at slowing the destruction of a rapidly changing climate. Do you worry that the same could happen with this type of research, that funding will be cut off or ended for it? Any movement along those lines that you've seen? Deani?
I have not seen anything in that regard. And I know that RFK Jr., microplastics are something that he has expressed concern over. That doesn't mean that I'm confident that we will continue to see lots of funding, because I think things are fairly up in the air in a lot of ways. But I do think that microplastics and plastics more broadly there's broader support to deal with microplastics than a lot of other environmental issues. And I think some of that comes from the fact that there's huge health implications for people, and that there's a lot of it where it's like we can do the right things in our own homes with using glass and using metal, but there is so much that it's really hard as individuals for us to avoid. And so I think a lot of people are excited about actually being able to have good options on the table. And so I have hope that we will continue to make progress on this issue.
And Pam, your thoughts there. As Deani noted, the new Health and Human Services Director, our commissioner, is concerned about microplastics, Mr. Kennedy. But as you noted earlier, there is the powerful lobby of the oil and gas industry that's seeking new places to sell their product. So how do you think that all kind of shakes out?
Yeah, I think it's with regard to research, I think it is a little uncertain at this moment about funding for research. But I'm even more concerned about the influence of this administration on policy. I mentioned the U.S. has played a very negative role in the treaty negotiations, especially since Trump has come into office under the Biden administration. I think there was a lot of interest and motivation to engage internationally on a strong plastics treaty, but I've never seen U.S. delegation at these international negotiations that behaved so badly. And Trump actually sent letters to certain delegations threatening them if they would continue to fight for reductions in production of plastics. So this impinges directly on the extraction of fossil fuels as well as the production of chemicals and plastics themselves. So I think we have to be concerned about the research, and I think Deani is right that there's a lot of interest among the public in protecting our health. So I think that's an optimistic area. I think the influence of the administration on national and international policy is much more frightening to me at this point.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much to my guests today, Pam Miller and Deani Chapman. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. Our editor is Annie Feit. And on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.